When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis, and today I am with the Godfathers. We got Sean, Jamie, and Paul. How are you guys doing today?
Hey, good. Thanks, Dennis.
Great.
Perfect. Perfect. So if you wouldn't mind, it's your opportunity to shine. Go around the room and just do a real quick introduction to yourself. So I'll stop at the bottom of the pool there. Paul, how are you? Can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Dennis. Start with the gutter medic. yep, I just retired. I had 20 years in the military. I started as a 68 Whiskey, ended up as an 18 Delta, instructed at the schoolhouse. And I ran a couple of other programs that I'm now at Ragged Edge.
Perfect. Perfect. Jamie.
Yeah, just started out as a family medicine doc after Uniformed Services University, was quickly awakened to the idea of how cool special operations medicine is by some of my classmates that were former 18 Deltas, realized I missed that boat. So I tried to get into special operations as early and quickly as I could. And was fortunate to be able to be a part of that community for about 15 years. And then when Sean really started leading the charge with prolonged field care, I was absolutely hooked, because that's what we all go into medicine for. So really, really glad to have been a part of that and able to work with Sean on that. Not right from the beginning, but at least pretty early on.
Perfect. Sean, last but not least.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Hey, it's Sean. I'm an ER and EMS doc. Retired after 27 years in the Army. I got really lucky early on in my career where somebody allowed me to be a Special Forces Battalion doc before I was residency trained, and kind of learned the hard way. But luckily was linked up with some really solid medics, 18 Deltas, that, you know, kind of squared me away and biased me from the early on. And so I spent 13 years in special operations, and towards the end of my career, was a 10th Special Forces Group surgeon. We were sending a bunch of guys to Africa, and we had a problem we needed to solve. So we formed the Coalition of the Willing. I was the original PFC working group coordinator, and we just started from a grassroots effort, and then it sprang into all of this. And, you know, through the efforts of many people, you know, prolonged field care is kind of a household name in military and austere medicine. So I was just happy to be a part of that.
Yeah, me too, as well. So since
you were the Dennis, you didn't introduce yourself.
I'm here on every week, so everybody knows me. So,
okay. All right.
But Sean, since you were plank holder, the original plank holder, if you wouldn't mind going through just some of the brief history of prolonged field care.
Yeah, so I was a group surgeon at the time, 10th Special Forces Group. And since I had been battalion surgeon twice before, I kind of sort of knew that there's opportunities. And the SOMA meeting, which happened in Tampa in December, you know, was coming out. And I said to the then president, my former residency classmate, Bob Mabry, said, hey, you know, we need to be talking about what's going on in other places besides Iraq and Afghanistan. We had tons of information. We were really good at tactical combat casualty care. And I said, you know, we need to be talking about what's going on, like in Africa, for instance. And he said, okay, smart guy, you know, we got these two guys and they're giving a presentation because they just came back from Africa. So Justin Ball and Chris Burns, actually kind of came up with three lessons observed from being stuck in the middle of nowhere in Africa, which ironically was where our medics were co-located, which ironically was where Paul went to like 6 months after this whole thing. And we formed this group over a couple lunchtimes, you know, and the original people, Justin Ball, Chris Burns, Philip Mason, our SEMA, Chris Moore, you know, we were sitting around and really just started observing those gaps. And then that built on to a meeting, you know, the next year during the SOMA meeting. I gave a presentation. At that time, I had that neck brace on because I had a couple of neck vertebrae fused. And one of my young medics, it was like, who happened to be Paul, was like, hey, I made a Facebook page. And I made a website. And I'm like, I don't understand all that stuff. And he's like, and there's this thing with all these little dots on it you can scan called QR code. And like, just put it up on a slide and let's see if we can get people to sign up. And totally just an unconventional warfare approach to like getting the word out there, you know, and we were really doing things ad hoc. Justin Ball originally was doing this podcast. And he's like, well, I don't know how to do a podcast. Let's call, you know, Dr. Scott Weingart, because he's got this really popular one called MCRIT, figure out how he does it. And it was really just kind of sticks and rags putting this thing together. And then we started building a little bit of momentum. Paul started the website, again, on his own dollar and his own time. And then we started to get the attention of the policymakers and some of the other folks. So the Joint Trauma System, you know, Dr. Stacey Shackford and her talented staff jumped on. They said, hey, how can we help you to get the word out, because we recognize this is a problem. And then, you know, we were invited to go and speak at some meetings, and I would just show pictures of Africa. And I said, hey, we got people out here. Imagine what it's like practicing medicine. And it really just opened people's, you know, imaginations and like, wow, there's something out there besides, you know, just the first 20 minutes of trauma care. And some people were really uncomfortable thinking about it because it was hard. It involved multiple medical specialties. Nobody was an expert. In fact, you know, that's one of our favorite things to say. It's like, no one is an expert, but how is it that we take those best practices? So the Joint Trauma System jumped on. We got the research groups, you know, Colonel Todd Rasmussen, and at the time was the JPC6, the Combat Casualty Research Program. And he invited me and Jamie to go to MHSRS meeting and really just, again, just to present the problem to them. And it was just an overwhelming response. And it was funny because I had actually flown to Florida for a total of 36 hours. And I was actually going to fly back to go proctor the Swedish Remedy exercise. And I got up there on the main stage, gave like a 15-minute presentation. And I said, and Jamie Risberg in the back will be happy to answer all your questions. And he like put his hand up, and I'm like, I'm out of here. I got to go back. And so I left it, you know, kind of, and that was one of the few times that, be careful what you ask for. Cause when Jamie was into it, he very quickly got a lot of, you know, a lot of, popularity. Then it kind of went forward. And then, we had some great training starting up a 10th Special Forces Group, 3rd Special Forces Group, Dr. Doug Powell, and then Sergeant First Class Roger Dale started something called the Mountain Path Exercise, which was really taking the full spectrum and inviting a lot of high profile folks, you know, both on the operational medicine side, Joint Trauma System, and really getting to see firsthand what this thing looks like. Roger then spun off and formed Ragged Edge Solutions as a company. I retired and worked with him, but then I also worked with the Joint Trauma System. And then we saw the evolution and the formalizing of the whole thing. With JTS picked it up, it came out from under soft medicine, you know, came into a formalized working group and is still there at the Joint Trauma System. And then I kind of faded away from active duty and now kind of just behind the scenes. But, you know, and then these guys like Paul and Jamie and you, I mean, you guys just picked up those very rudimentary initiatives and actually formalized them and turned them into what it is today. So, you know, hats off to you and your colleagues who remained on active duty to continue to, you know, pull this thing along. Yeah, I'm happy to get into any details, but I've talked too much. Thanks.
One of the things that you brought up, Sean, you kind of skipped through it in the beginning, but those lunchtime meetings, and I think that's when Jamie came into the picture, is like that was early on in the first year. I remember seeing your face sitting around the table there. But as a medic going to, you know, faraway lands as a lone E6 on a team, or maybe you have a junior medic with you, like that's a pretty daunting task. And to be in those battalion and group wide meetings where you have 10, 15 guys in the same room with the same problem, like that's a little comforting and reassuring when you're faced with a problem like that. So I can't, you know, overestimate like how much that actually helped me, even if it was just us talking about the problems. It allowed me to kind of ping off my ideas that I would have off of you guys before I had to go somewhere and do something. So that was extremely powerful for me.
Yeah. So also, Paul, you know, since you did the website and you've put so much effort into all of this, why do you think this has actually taken off as much as it has, and or not? You know, just how, why do you think it's done well on maybe the medic end and maybe not so well in other areas?
You know, from my perspective, you, when you're starting a grassroots thing and there's an absolute need for it, maybe there's not a requirement for it, but there's a need for this type of training, because those are the situations that we find ourselves in. The training that we were getting did not address the length of time that we needed to be able to take care of patients. Like, it just did not match up. And all the medics understood this. The battalion docs understood this. Sean at the group level understands it. Third group ended up, you know, taking that shit sandwich from us, and they understood it. But if you're not there, it's hard to appreciate, just like I was saying, what I was saying before, how daunting that problem is. And so once you're a medic and you deploy somewhere like that, you're like, oh man, like, this really is my problem, and it's nobody else's problem. And SF guys are deploying all the time. The former DCG of First Special Forces Command was in an open forum, said, hey, we're in over 70 countries with over 1,900 people. So that means people are constantly deploying and constantly facing the same problem. And they come back and they share best practices. And it's it blew up pretty good from that right there. What do you think, Jamie?
Yeah, absolutely. I think at the grassroots level, we keep using that term, but at the medic level, my favorite story is still when Staff Sergeant Curtis came to me and he goes, hey, we've done our mission analysis for where we're going to be in Central Africa, and it's a 26-hour minimum evacuation time. That's if the weather's good and the runway's not muddy, because, oh, by the way, it was a dirt FLS that they carved out of the African bush. And he said the nearest Western-trained surgeon at best is 36 hours away. How in the world am I supposed to hold on to this guy? And I said, well, doctrine says that the 18 Delta can hold a patient 72 hours, right? By the way, that's false. Nobody has ever been able to find me that doctrine, nor have I found it after extensive searching. So there was sort of, it was this collision of lore and what we've always thought since the 300 F1 days when the 18 Delta and the Special Operations Combat Medic was created. There was all this nursing care, veterinary medicine that was integrated with this concept being these medics are going to be out there on their own. But somehow we forgot that heritage after, you know, 10 plus years of GWAT. We were so focused on CENTCOM and rapid medical evacuation, we sort of forgot our roots. So much like Paul said, a lot of folks got into this realm of medicine because they love the complex problems. So when we hit them with a complex problem, these really long evacuation and really long patient hold times before they could get evac, they latched on.
Yeah. Yeah. Sean, you have more of a bird's eye view than maybe Paul and I. How do you think this has taken off in the clouds there?
Yeah. So basically people were dragged kicking and screaming to realize that they needed to do this, right? And it is hard. I'll be the first one to say it's super hard. Like, how do you take best practices from subspecialties and nursing and pre-hospital and emergency medicine and surgery and try to compress them down into a knowledge package that people can digest and actually reproduce and do that, right? But then what happened was we realized that, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore. We're not in GWAT. And stuff started happening around the world where people, you know, were looking and saying, whoa, wait a minute. You know, we may have this Indo-Pacific theater type war and it's not going to be like, you know, easy. And it was remarkable, actually stunning to me that people would say, well, like, wait a minute, I just did a mission analysis and I'm not going to have a helicopter. And I'm like that never occurred to you before. And all of a sudden, you just had these light bulbs going on around the service, around these strategic level thinkers saying, oh, we got, you know, we might have this near peer adversary and we may not be able to evacuate patients. And you know, we're all just sitting here because we've been doing this 10 years going, well, no crap, man. Like, that's every day. That's a Tuesday in Softland. But, you know, and what they started to do was they started to look at that. But then they realized some people started to recreate the wheel. Some people, you know, went high and right on some of their concepts. And I think a lot of people said, well, that's just too hard, or we don't have the funding for that, or that would be great in an ideal world, but why don't we just, you know, put an extra ship in the Pacific, or why don't we just get an extra helicopter or make some fancy drone and that'll save all our problems. But again, when you look at those surrogate experiences, we look at Eastern Europe and Ukraine problem set. We look at what's happening in you know, the Middle East today, or we look at the greatest threat, you know, the Indo-Pacific theater, and you start to realize that there are some common themes emerging. And it's tough, right? And what I know the Navy's looking at and saying, we don't even baseline train our people or equip our people for these problem sets. And they're trying to just wrap their brain around that. I think we have a tremendous head start, but it's very easy when you are, you know, you only know what you know, and you're brought up in this doctrinal world. And they say, well, that's what the soft guys do. They're special. They have extra money. They have extra training. We can never be like them. But when you turn and ask us what's going on, we're just saying, this is just good medicine in a resource limited environment. Let's try to find the commonalities, because there's a lot of good and a lot of published data, whether it's formal, you know, through clinical practice guidelines or research papers, or whether it's informal, like this podcast or the website. And this effort has always been grassroots, but it's always been to provide a service, to provide a quality service to those people who need it. And I think that's why it has been sustained, despite the fact that it doesn't have formal funding, formal requirements, you know, large formal requirements. But I think people are realizing there's a lot of goodness in this, and we need to tap into that.
Jamie?
Yeah. So, Sean, as you address that, I mean, certainly this isn't just a DOD unique problem. Like, I think of Frank Butler, right, when he started tactical combat casualty care. Well, Wilderness Medicine was right there alongside. That first T-Tri-C paper was published in Wilderness Medicine. So where do you see the civilian analog on this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we started, so having been involved with training, so getting back to the whole training aspect, really, because that's what it comes down to. How do you educate and train people knowing that you're not going to have fellowship training, like that we're going to have people that are either don't have the experience, don't have the resources, don't have the, you know, baseline training to talk about the concepts. So what, at the Special Operations Medical Association meeting, we all ran many pre-conference courses, which were filled to capacity, 100 people in a room talking about training. And we talked about how do we educate and train over and over again. We did it like 3 or 4 years in a row. And the same people were there looking at us going, but how do we do it? But how do we do it? And so we realized there's a huge gap there. So when I retired, I got together with Roger, Bill Vashius, you know, now Paul, Rich, and we formed a small company to try to figure out how to train that. And we took all those constraints, and we think we came up with some very good best practices. Now, of course, I'm biased, and a lot of you all are biased because you've taught there. But what we found out was that we found out how to provide quality training in a compact, you know, group. And so then what we decided to do, because, you know, being a small private company, what we did is we spun off a nonprofit called Specialized Medical Standards, and we actually made a formal curriculum specifically looking for a civilian audience, because we had many different civilian people. Originally, the committee of TECC, those founders came to us and said, hey, what we did for tactical combat casualty care, you guys need to do for prolonged field care. So we created a curriculum called Austere Emergency Care. And I live in Colorado. Jamie does now too. But bottom line was, I said, let's just take this to the, I won't call them the street paramedics, but we'll call them the paramedics working in rural areas. And we're just going to put it in front of them and see what, you know, what the uptake might be. And I just described prolonged field care. I said, hey, we had this problem in this military, and it's this and it's that and all that. And like one guy just raised his hand. He goes, well, yeah, we call that a normal run in rural Colorado, because it takes us an hour to get in there. We're going to go on a dirt road. We may have, you know, crappy weather. And then I have to manage that patient for an hour and a half with a protocol that lasts me 18 minutes. Like, this stuff is entirely applicable. But because, just like in the military, there's a baseline necessary you know, ABCDE or MARCH that everybody needs to know. They all learn that and they all retrain on that. But then the rural guys who are a minority necessarily go out and try to put that into practice. And they say, you know, if I only had a little bit more. And so by putting that in front of civilians, not even, we're not talking about SWAT paramedics. We're not talking about TEMS. We're not talking about critical care paramedics, just normal paramedics, the EMTs. And then doing that in Norway and then doing that in New Zealand and seeing the same exact comments coming back and saying, this is a problem we all have. It really kind of rang, you know, home to me to say they looked at this and said, I know it's military and we don't often see this, but you guys got to get this word out. So the uptake has been even more, I guess, universal than I would have expected. So.
Yes, yeah.
That's kind of, you know, that's my experience. So,
absolutely, and you know, some people are always going to be thirsty just for more knowledge, more capability. I mean, I think that's just in our DNA to become more capable and better at our jobs. But speaking of training, right? People asking for training, how do I do this type of stuff? I guess. What is kind of the way forward? Because it's prolonged field care is actually not only is it difficult to accomplish, it's difficult to train because it's a mix of very easy, very basic things over and over and over again. And occasionally there are some very complicated, thought-provoking, like you really have to dig deep and think about what you're getting ready to do things. You know, I guess how can we do better as either EMS on the civilian side or military medics on the other? I'll start with you, Paul. But you know, how can we do better? What are they missing?
Yeah, one thing Sean said at the beginning of his last response was something about it being hard, and since it's hard, we probably shouldn't do it. I've heard that from a few people, like, sorry, we can't solve your impossible problem was one direct quote to me. I'm like, okay, thanks. Those problems still exist, whether you want to ignore them or not. And when we actually looked in 2015 and we started, you know, kind of assessing our own forces to be able to do this, you know, guys that have been through the course, been on teams, been instructors in narrow fields, like they didn't do too well either. You know, without specific training, you're only going to be good at what you've already done and what you've done well. So when we set that baseline, it was really low. That bar was extremely low from the get-go from that double exercise that we ran in 2015. And for me, just watching that happen, that was like day one of my instructor career, watching these other medics go through it. I noticed that they were just kind of missing fundamental principles, not just of medicine or tactical medicine, TCCC, but of all the prolonged field care stuff. Like they weren't trending vital signs. They didn't have a problem list and a care plan. And so that's the first time that I wrote those things down. And a lot of that stuff has kind of stayed true. And we still teach a lot of it today. When you talk about the limited time and money, for me, knowing exactly where a lot of these guys have been, man, all you got to do is if you're doing a TCCC scenario, just walk it out for the next hour, the next 2 hours. So if you're already taking all the time, whether you're on a CQB range or whatever you're doing in a shoot house, or just, you know, out on a different type of range, just walk it out, you know, do your initial TCCC care and then say, and now what? It really helps to have an experienced instructor proctor giving you vital signs, but you kind of know what's going on in the background. And if you are mindful enough, you can kind of step back yourself and say, okay, how could I do this situation better? You're going to maximize your training time and dollars just by doing that alone. There are some things you're probably not going to get. You need expertise for many scenarios, but if you just start walking your scenarios out a little bit longer, I think it's going to help a lot.
Yeah. Yep. Jamie, how about you?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Paul. I mean, here's the thing. We're in a fight with commanders to buy down risk, right? Ultimately, a commander's job is to buy down risk on the military side. Civilian side, it's the same thing, right? That EMS director is trying to save the most lives and make sure those paramedics forward have the tools and the algorithms they need. But you've only got so much time to train. Time's the most precious resource. So what Paul said is pure gold. When you've got an opportunity, your team or your group is together and they're out training, they're on the range, it's something totally not medically related. You have an opportunity to throw in some medical training. Minimum is walk it out. Make the scenario go a little bit longer. Put yourself in that situation and go, man, what medical equipment do I wish I had? Or what knowledge am I missing to take care of this patient, you know, in whatever scenario you develop? Better or best is have some medical experience, like Paul said, an advanced cadre, a PA doc, a senior medic out there to run some vitals for you and really challenge your thinking. Because ultimately, that's what prolonged care and prolonged field care are. It's you hit the end of the algorithm, now what? And when we were originally charged with writing the PFC guidelines by the Joint Trauma System, that's what the mission was. When you get to the end of T-tri-C, now what? And that's really what PFC has always sought to do. The problem is that's varsity level medicine, right? We're taking the best of critical care medicine, ICU medicine, emergency medicine, and we're making you do it in the dark and the dirt and the mud with limited resources. So that requires a special type of person. And I think that's partially why it's been so successful and so sticky, is people love that challenge. It's like these Spartan races. Or maybe it appeals to everybody's psyche with this zombie apocalypse fascination we all have with survivalism and doomsdayism, you know? Everybody wants to be prepared and have their blowout bags. Well, guess what? PFC is the ultimate doomsday scenario, right? It's when all your planning and your appropriate care for the patient goes out the window due to the environment, the enemy, whatever. And now you're forced to think on your feet and adapt to the contingency. That appeals to people, right? You know, walking through the supermarket the other day, I saw Survivalist, Contingency magazine, right? All these things, how to build your blowout bag, how to build your shelter in the backyard, which guns to buy, right? And PFC is that same thing. It's how do you prepare for your worst day? And what do you do when your evacuation doesn't show up? So like Paul said, that is not rocket science to train that. You just need to give it the time that it warrants.
Yep, absolutely. Sean?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, and the thing is, people said, like, what is PFC? You know, is it a set of guidelines? You know, originally when we said it was an operational problem. And when the leadership of these small teams go through it, they realize the value, because not only is it medical training problem, it's they get to practice all of their problems. They get to team movements and contingency operations and communication plans and all of that. And when you see a full team go through an exercise, many times it's not the medics that get the best training. It's the non-medics and the leadership that gets best training. And once they've been through it, a lot of people saying, how can I get more of this? Because it's just, it's an operational problem that happens to be built around medicine, opposed to, you know, a course or something like that. And I think mature operators understand that, you know, wow, this is something that I can get a tremendous amount of value in. And it buys down risk. I remember having a young Navy SEAL come up to me, non-medic, and he was like, now I know what happens after TC3. He said, I never knew. I knew, you know, I studied all this. I'm not a medic, but I memorized everything I was supposed to do. And I always said to myself, what then? Because he's a smart guy. And he's like, there's got to be something else. He was able to go through that scenario and then he could imagine it. And it took away that boogeyman aspect of it. He's like, oh, okay. I know not only can I do stuff, but I can contribute. And then a lot of those guys will go back and say, teach me more. And the cool thing about it is, you know, when does a medic ever get to be, you know, the rock star on the team, right? They're always at the range, they're doing demo, they're doing driving, whatever. This is the one time that everyone else looks at the medic and be like, hey man, teach me more. This is good stuff. And so there's tons of value of going through these exercises, whether it's tabletop, whether it's just an abridged thing afterwards, and you just kind of talk through the contingency, or you actually live through this. And that's really, I think, where the training comes in. You're not going to teach people to be adept at every single presentation, but what you're going to do is you're going to open up their imagination. And then these type A individuals are going to go back and go, man, I screwed that up. I wish I knew more about this. And then they start learning stuff. Then they get into the podcast. Then they get into the website. Then they start looking for additional stuff because finally they have something to wrap their brain around. And I think that's really how educating and training well, if you can kind of inspire them to go and learn more. And then you know, so that's super satisfying, I think, when you see those light bulbs start to go on with the medics and the non-medics.
Yep. Hey, Jamie.
Yeah. So, and what's great about this too, Dennis, is there's a risk, right? As we're communicating the goodness of prolonged field care and all this, you know, amazing work that just volunteers have done. And that is, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. T-Tri-C is still foundational, right? That is still the core to everything we do. Or tech, if you're in tactical EMS or, you know, wilderness medicine. Doing those basics well ensures you have a live patient to treat during prolonged field care. In the same way, if you, as Sean said early on, you know, Sean and Paul and Chris Moore and Justin developed some great rules. You know, they took the soft truths and they adapted them to prolonged field care. And Sean, you remember that, and you put that on all your ending slides as we started the movement. And one of those was, if you need a surgeon or an intensivist in the field to really help your patients survive, then put one there. Well, guess what? The reality is we just don't have enough in the inventory anywhere. DOD, civilian, you're never going to have enough surgeons to establish a level one trauma center in Bohunky Village, wherever, right? You're never going to get the standard of care that you want for a vast majority of these populations. So what we did is inadvertently, we created this large delta, this huge gap between all of these amazing things the Joint Trauma System was accomplishing in Afghanistan and Iraq, amazing capabilities that became the standard. But at the same time, we were not improving anything for the main interface at point of injury, which is the medic or the corpsman. So we had done a medevac, we'd created an amazing Joint Trauma System, and there was things that were changing for the medic and the corpsman, but not fast enough to keep up with all the other system-based change we were doing over the course of the GWAT. Prolonged field care attempted to bridge that gap. It attempted to step in and say, how do we give the guy or the gal on the ground, in the dirt, at point of injury, or holding that patient, unable to evacuate them, the tools they need so that they don't feel like they've completely checked out on their patient? And what we found was we were really helping defeat bad habits. Bad habits being 9-minute medevac. I'm just going to package, stop bleeding, and call for medevac. That was no longer the reality, right? It never really was if you look back historically over all of our wars. And so how did we get back to the thinking medic, make the medic great again? And that was really, in my mind, one of the beauties of it. We didn't throw out T-Tri-C. We never said, don't put surgeons there if you need them. Absolutely put surgeons there. Get surgeons far forward. Work those problems. But while you all are working that problem, we're going to work the problem of empowering the person on the ground that's taking care of the patient.
Yep, absolutely. So kind of on that and training and experiences that way, do you guys have any lessons learned from, you know, what makes good training, what makes crappy training? Start with you, Paul.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on something that Jamie said real quick. And I think there's so much value in just writing things down. You know, now that we have the clinical practice guidelines, we have the website, whether that exists in 30 or 50 years or, you know, any of these podcast episodes. Like when we started and we asked some of these guys, you know, some of the older guys were like, oh yeah, that's what we always did. We're like, all right, cool. But how do we do it? Where'd you write it down? What are the principles? What, you know, like what, yeah, you did it, but what does that mean? You know, did you do it well? So at least it's written down. And if nothing else, this stuff should exist for a while. I was thinking about that for the CPGs. You know, some of them are now 5, 6, 7 years old, but even if they never get updated, you have somewhere to start in the future. You know, if this happens to come back around like things do. So for training specifically, I would say start there at the CPGs, start at your known gaps in your own assessment of your own exercises. If you're non-medics are out there and they can't put on tourniquets, you got to start there. You got to start with TCCC and you have to be invested. You have to have your chain of command be invested. You have to care. You have to make them care also. And then from there, you can start adding on more complex problems, but you always got to start at the beginning. Every time I go out, like we start with TCCC or some kind of baseline thing that you have to do before we get on to the more complex things. So always rehash the basics.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, basics are king, right? I get a lot of guys.
And there's
talking
a lot of
about,
basics that are.
Go ahead, Sean. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say there's a lot of basics now. Now with damage control resuscitation, now with the early administration of fresh whole blood, there are some clear standards out there that you can, you know, minimum be really good at T-Tri-C. You know, if you're not a combat lifesaver and you're not medic, be a combat lifesaver. Now we've got the fresh whole blood resuscitation. Now we've got a little bit more on top of that. There's always things, and there's tidbits or almost like modules that you can train for. So you don't need a whole course necessarily, but take a good hard look. Because if you don't know the basics, and you can't do that during the day when you're well caffeinated and well rested, you sure as hell aren't going to do it at 2 a.m. when you're in hour 13. I know, I've seen it, right? And so I think the biggest threat with this education and training is when you have experienced instructors, for instance, and they're like, let me show you how cool I am with all my big doctor words. And let me show you how I'm going to, you know, run a ventilator and do these 3 drips on this patient. Let me show you all the cool stuff that I know, because that's my world. It's not that sexy, and it won't be that sexy, right? So really just taking a hard look at the people in front of you and saying, hey, do I need to slow this down and make sure they really understand the good stuff? Or can I ramp it up just a little bit and add a little bit more? You know, and you can always add stuff. And again, if you're training people that are professionals, that are type A individuals, you don't have to critique them whatsoever. You don't have to grade them, nor should you. You just provide them with that training environment and they will critique themselves. And I know people that have come back to training 3 or 4 times and they say, I just want to do it again because I went back and I read stuff and I'm pushing myself a little better. I trained my team a little better. Push us again. And that's really what it is. I mean, it's not super sexy. Again, I push back hard when people say, oh, well, that's a special operations thing. We can't possibly do that. Because I've seen people that are slightly motivated with very little training absolutely walk away with some great stuff if the training is done correctly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've seen it over and over again. You know, when you're providing that feedback, I mean, I think that's the ultimate grade you could possibly give somebody is positive feedback after, you know, doing a correct intervention, just giving that realistic feedback, those realistic vital signs, so that people understand there's consequences, both good and bad, with really anything and everything you do. You have to be smart enough to know, is this a good intervention? Am I capable of dealing with the negative consequences of it? You know, or is this something that I shouldn't do right now? You know, maybe when the patient's more stable, that's a more appropriate time. So being able to do that risk stratification and just giving good feedback is, I think, way more valuable than any comment I can give to somebody. And it hits a lot deeper, like I said, than any opinion somebody can give.
One thing that kind of frustrates me a little bit is now that, and it's not just us, you know, we have a whole coalition of the willing and a bunch of other people. But when you see people try to approach a problem, they're like, well, I got a slightly better way of doing this. And I look back on, and they're saying, I have this other way of documenting. I have this other way that I want to call a teleconsultation. I think what people don't appreciate is that there have been some very senior people working this problem for 6 or 8 or 10 years. There's been research. There are medical experts that have written these clinical practice guidelines. So I would just say, please don't try to reinvent all of this kind of stuff because you're in a different service or anything. Please take the best practices that are free and available and start there, you know, and don't try to make it all sexy just because you're a triple board certified, whatever you are. Just really just get those basics down, right? I mean, the flow sheets and the nursing sheets and the stuff that's out there, use that, because this has been hard, but a lot of the lessons learned have been captured and are readily available through forums like this. And I would just ask, you know, that if you're a junior supervisor or medical director, just, you know, embrace what's out there and get up to speed on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Jamie?
Yeah, principles. You know, in addition to what Sean said and Paul said, there have been some really smart people working this problem set. But we also have to acknowledge that much of it is an evidence-based medicine free zone, right? There's not going to be a good controlled trial of, you know, what happens after your 6th unit of walking donor donated blood at hour 12 in the Arctic, right? You're just not going to get that study. So we have to come back to principles. We have great evidence-based medicine for a lot of military trauma. And so what a lot of the smart people have done, plank holders, people on this call, you know, guys like, I think of Doug Powell and Andre Kapp and Stacy Shackelford, all these big names that everybody knows, lots of publications, right? Really smart people that understand the physiology and the medicine, but can also understand the environment. And they really helped build a lot of these initial CPGs. So what Sean said is pure gold. Even if you don't memorize the CPG or you decide that you want to go a different way than that, that's fine. But at least go back to the principles, because those principles are sound and they're based on solid medicine, whether that medicine's from the ICU, the emergency department, or in some cases I was amazed when I was writing the change paper in the COTSI for abdominal evisceration. I stumbled upon a little gem of a paper that looked at 10 years of war trauma in Niger and Jos. And basically this surgeon there had gone through and documented every surgical case, over 100 of them, that presented more than 6 hours from point of injury. So these are all prolonged field care patients. Some of them were as long as 72 hours, most of them with severe abdominal trauma, blunt or penetrating, eviscerations, and all of them alive without surgery when they presented to the hospital. Survival bias, I know. The ones that were going to die already died out in the field. So the ones they saw at the hospital were the ones that were going to survive anyhow. But those were, it was a great evidence-based validation of, yeah, this is the stuff medics have been asking questions about for years. What do I do when I'm sitting on that evisceration? Yeah, I've covered it, everything else. What happens next? So as we started peeling back the layers, we found there is a lot of evidence out there. It's just we're going to have to work to extrapolate it. And then we're going to have to design studies, which, you know, throw a plug for UC Combat, the research center there, because they are taking this on in South Africa in environments where prolonged field care is an everyday thing. So Sean and some other great folks are really helping lead that. The last thing I'd say for training, Dennis, and this is critical, stick with the principles, because I'm always amazed by the smart people that engage on this, the things they come up with. Every time we do PFC with soft medics, with austere emergency care, civilian paramedics, they come up with, once they understand the principle, let's say urine output. Hey, you need to monitor urine output to gauge your resuscitation. I am amazed every time I see this, that they all design new ways to work around the Foley, new ways to capture urine, new ways to look at that problem without the expensive widget. So to Sean's point, it need not be expensive. You don't need all the soft medicine, you know, resourcing. All you need is some creativity. Throw a plug for that. David Epstein, great book called Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a World of Specialization. David Epstein, Range. He talks about who makes the best jazz musicians. And I think this is a great analogy for prolonged field care. The answer is it experienced musicians, the Dizzy Gillespies of the world that have classical training out the wazoo, or is it the person that just picks up the guitar or the horn and just starts playing and has no classical music training? The answer is both, and it's the same in PFC. We've seen non-medical people become amazing prolonged field care providers just because they can grasp the principles and really help their medic out. We've also seen really advanced providers jump in and come up with innovative solutions. But the heart of all of that is the ability to understand the principle and improvise. Last thing for training, move your team every 3 to 4 hours. If you're doing prolonged field care, you got to move every 3 hours. Where do patients die in the trauma system? They die during transitions. Whether that's the transition from the emergency department to the CAT scanner or back again, they die in transitions. Transitions are a vulnerable time. So when you do PFC, exercise that by forcing the team to move. That also forces them to package, reassess, and you discover things as the trainer.
Yep, absolutely. So we're hitting up on time. Let's go around the horn. I'll start with you, Jamie. Do you have any final thoughts?
My only thought is thank you. Thank you to this community, to the people that are listening to this podcast. This, like, none of us would be doing this. And I know... I'm so thankful for Sean, for you, Dennis, for Paul, and the work you all have done. But I know all of us on this call would acknowledge, for each one of us, there's 50 or 60 people we know that have done heavy lifting, that have wrote papers, written papers, that have, you know, gone to fight in all the meetings at the command level, at the combined joint staff level, all the way down to the ground level, just fighting to get that widget in their aid bag so they can have a peep valve on their BVM. Thank you. Thank you to all those people.
John?
Yeah, same way as Jamie. Thank you. It's the motivation and the interest that other people have brought, and just the feedback, I think, that has allowed a lot of us to continue to, you know, do this in our free time. You know, I've always enjoyed being a medical director so I could provide top cover and hopefully make things a little bit better for, you know, my guys on the ground. And so to have them come back and show interest and really embrace this, it makes it very rewarding, right? More so than a paycheck or anything like that. It really has provided a certain amount of meaning. And honestly, the thing that I really appreciated is when it became policy and people said, oh man, it's, you know, it's being watered down, it's being picked up. But I saw that as being an actual win for the grassroots, you know, like it went from being an insurgency to actually being the government. Right. And so it's almost like what you hope to see in soft when somebody else picks up the idea and just goes with it. But it couldn't have happened without the, you know, the many years and hours, you know, and to you, Dennis, you picked up the podcast and you're just crushing it right now. Paul, you're continuing to crush it, you know, even when you're retired. So, in fact, you know, I said this before. Can you kind of give a sense just over the past year or so as to kind of the listenership or, you know, how often you guys are putting out stuff? Because it's really actually ramping up, you know, sticking with the basics, going with what is there. But can you guys give us some, you know, idea?
Yeah, I can do quick on the podcast side. As far as frequency of podcasts, we're putting out new podcasts every week. We do that on Monday. And then on Friday, we'll put out an older podcast that is obviously still relevant, just to maintain that kind of the basics type of thing and make sure people are it's not getting lost in the stack, as it were, while people are constantly wanting to hear about the new hotness in whatever. So I'm constantly putting that stuff out. So really, we're putting out two podcasts a week, and we've been able to sustain that since this last spring. So almost a full year of just hard putting out podcasts, as far as putting out podcasts, recording things and such. And viewership and interaction engagement has gone up even higher, and not just in the U.S., but across the world. We're getting listeners from, you know, the usual suspects in Europe, South America, Asia, and there could be spies watching as well. But we're getting like China and Iran and, you know, all these foreign actors that maybe we don't necessarily want to talk to. But, you know, like you're talking about that kind of guerrilla movement. Even in those countries, the people don't necessarily are not necessarily against us. There are, and even in those countries, there are people that are, they just want to live their lives and are be able to take care of themselves. So, you know, even if they're in a country maybe we don't necessarily agree with politically, we're still hitting listeners that want to take care of people and very, very austere locations where a lot of things are denied. So when it comes to that kind of global outreach, like, we've hit just about every country you can think of.
Yeah, I'll add on to
and
that.
We're like, doing,
when I checked your stats on YouTube, say, and Dennis, we're hitting, like, it was amazing.
Yeah, go ahead.
We'll see you later, Dave.
You know, when we're hitting the subtitles as well. Sorry about that, Paul.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, Jamie had to take off there, but I was going to say, when we looked at the subtitles, the YouTube channel, like having 2 million views on the YouTube channel alone, and then that's not Spotify, that's not all these other engines and, you know, apps that people are using. It's pretty mind-blowing. So I think you're hitting the right people, and then a whole lot of others that are just interested, which is awesome.
Yeah,
it was funny because Paul and I were in Denmark, like 2 months ago. And it's funny because people come up to me and ask me a question and say, hey, remember when Dennis was talking to that guy last month? And I'm like, well, I haven't listened to that one yet. And then they start asking me a question about it. And so I'm absolutely amazed. Like, people just come out of nowhere and be like, oh, yeah, well, Dennis talked about that last month and everything. So but to see people in other countries that I've never met before come up and say, like, oh, man, this is great. You know, and they actually – some of these people really do follow this. So, hey, thank you all for that. I mean, because that's super cool just to be able to, you know, get out and meet people and talk to them about this type of stuff. And they're into it. You know, they're really into it, which is cool.
Yeah. I mean, I'm, again, my turn to say thank you. Thank you, Paul and Jamie and Sean for inviting me to the Prolonged Field Care Working Group way back when I was an absolute nobody living in a basement, allowing me to a voice in something that even at the time I knew was incredibly important. And I'd also like to thank the listeners for even putting up with the sound of my voice for this long and not causing major accidents, because it's just incredibly powerful. It's very, very humbling to know that you are literally educating the world when it comes to taking care of people in really bad places, really bad situations. And so I definitely carry that burden with a lot of pride and a lot of thought to make sure that we're putting out good information that can really be used anywhere.
Yeah, I would second that, Dennis. I think the stuff that you've been able to pick up and run with has been extremely useful. It's not just a bunch of, getting on here and bloviating about theory. We actually talk about, hey, this is what you can do next time you're out there with a patient. And that's kind of the feeling that I always had with this. Like, there's always been part of me that, when we first started, it's like, hey, do we make just a bunch of podcasts and then release them slowly? And then that's really hard for me, because I know like somebody might have a patient that I talked about in a podcast and I'm just going to hold on to it for 6 weeks. So I think us getting things out with urgency because we care is something that's made a difference for me of why I've stayed in this. Because, as soon as you do something, you release it, as soon as we possibly can. And, that's because we've always kept the medics at heart. That's the forefront of why we always do this. And the things that we've been able to take from medics and say, hey, here's a bunch of good ideas, thanks guys, and then put them back out to the community. A lot of the stuff, like Sean alluded to way early in this podcast, it happened because medics found a workaround. They found something that worked for them. We took it, we included it, we put it into the guidelines, and it's by medics for medics with a lot of oversight and help from other doctors and PAs and so many other people out there. It's been really cool to be a part of for 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Sean, any last thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to say, how do we keep the goodness going, right? So we mentioned that we've made it, that nonprofit company for the austere emergency care. Well, last year we brought with the newly named Prolonged Field Care Collective up under the nonprofit company called Specialized Medical Standards. And so what that allowed us to do was to streamline some of the operations behind the scenes, right? So you can see us now, right? You got camera equipment, you got these fancy like recording things. And that has really been with the sponsors and with people who wanted to help out. So we've got a Patreon account, right? Didn't even know what one was like last year, but it's a way that people can just have a little tiny deduction every month. Just give us a little bit of money, really. And it pays for stuff like the subscriptions and the cameras so you can see us and the ability to do this. And we've seen what Dennis and Paul have been able to do with it over the past year, right? So just a little bit of investment really from the community, is huge. And then we've got some sponsors, some corporate sponsors. And then, hey, if they want to meet you guys live, right? We're going to be at SOMA this year. So the SOMSA meeting, Raleigh, North Carolina, May 13 to 17. And we got a booth there, and we may even do some recording live there. So if people have got some good ideas, want to reach out to Dennis, or whatever, and just get in touch with us. So there are ways to help support that. And the intent is, again, to take it away from the personalities, but actually make it into a process that'll make it sustainable. So hopefully, we'll be recording the 15 and 20 year versions. Maybe not me. Hopefully I can find somebody to do this besides me, but
yeah. Paul?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Sean. Like having a certificate with the nonprofit, having a civilian course that then we can use in our training, and using the sound principles, having a board that kind of looks at all the things that we're training and how we're doing it, that's really important. And then as we move forward, I think looking at the CPGs that I was talking about before, that you know, some of them are 5, 6, 7 years old. It's time to update those. And that's going to be a huge opportunity to kind of go a little bit further, is because when you start talking about irregular warfare medicine, that's not just your 6 to 12 hour evac. That's you taking care of a partner force for longer than that. So there was a great case on Reddit the other days, if you guys ever get on that subreddit of tactical medicine, where a guy had a burn patient for over 7 days and, you know, had to take care of him. And people were talking about, hey, do we put on any kind of topical ointment? And it's not in the CPG. So we're going to be addressing things like that moving forward, I think.
Yeah, perfect. Well, again, thank you, guys. Thank you, Jamie, wherever you are in the world right now. You know, I really appreciate you coming on and just kind of hashing this stuff out.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity. And Happy New Year.
For today's podcast, be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Boy, it's waiting there for you.